Chapter 2 Monaco, at dusk, was bathed in thick copper-red light as the dome diffused the last rays of the sun into a homogeneous glow, banishing shadows. Buildings seemed to shine of their own accord. Charlotte Fielder admired the town's tasteful stone-fronted buildings through the window of the chauffeured Aston Martin. Monaco's architecture was a counterfeit of the late 19th century, a blend of French and Spanish. Hacienda mansions, apartment blocks with elegant white facades, black railings, red clay tiles, verandas festooned with scarlet flowering geraniums growing out of pots. It was the kind of flawless recreation which only truly idle money can achieve. Hardly any of the town was more than 20 years old, so little had survived the razing, when the citizens of Nice had marched on the principality in search of food. Charlotte had been 3 years old when it happened, but she'd seen AV recordings of the aftermath at school. They reminded her of bombed-out towns from some war zone. Dunes of rubble, where a few walls and archways had endured the maddened assault to jut skywards like pagan altars. Soot-blackened bricks, burnt spikes of wood, wisps of smoke twisting lazily. The heat-expanded Mediterranean Sea had risen to swirl around that part of the town built on landfill sites, its filth-curdled water pushing a greasy tideline of bodies and seaweed along the crumpled streets. Even the colours had leached out of the images, fixing the scene in her mind as grainy black-and-white desolation. The destruction had been spectacular, even by the standards of a Europe which had almost collapsed into anarchy in those first few years of climatical tumult engendered by the warming. Charlotte retained only vague recollections of her early childhood, when the world was plunged into chaos. Dream sequences of places and faces, a seemingly endless procession of days when it was too hot and there was never enough to eat. Half of her waking hours had been spent roaming London's wide bicycle-clogged streets, scavenging food from markets and street stalls. She had lived with her Aunt Mavis, a woman in her late 40s, with a round, haunted face, always wearing floral print dresses and pink slippers. Aunt Mavis never had a job, by design a lifetime dole dependent. She only took Charlotte in for the extra food allocation. Charlotte never saw any of it. Her ration cards were traded with the spivs for bootleg gin, which Aunt Mavis would sit and drink in front of the big flat screen on the lounge wall, curtains perpetually drawn. The woman had exchanged reality for globe-cast soaps, where formatted plots always rewarded a hard life with the glitter trappings of materialism and golden sunsets, love and caring. The channels offered her a glimpse of salvation from the warming and the PSP, a world twisted out of recognition, becoming an electronic religion substitute, worshipped ceaselessly. One evening, when she was 7, Charlotte had returned home to find her aunt pressed against the flat screen, knocking on it tearfully and pleading with the handsome, smiling characters to let her in. She had been put in an orphanage not long after. The hunger ended then, replaced by work in the kitchens, peeling vegetables, washing crockery. That was when her life really began, the normality of school and other children. The only link with her past was a solid thread of determination never to be hungry again. Then Dmitri Baronsky had come into her world when she was 15, and he made his offer, opening a door into a semi-magical realm where nobody ever lacked for anything. The Aston Martin reached Monaco's perimeter road, where the seamless translucent shell of the dome rose out of the concrete sea wall, curving gradually overhead, massive enough to hold up the sky. She could see a couple of jetties on the outside, sleek, white-painted yachts bobbing gently at their moorings. Large circular tidal turbine lagoons of jean-tailored coral mottled the quiet sea all the way out to the darkening horizon. Monaco still refused to plug into France's electrical grid, remaining resolutely independent. On the other side of the road were dignified hotels with black glass lobby doors and long balconies. She watched them go past, feeling a vague sense of amusement that a town which had so meticulously recreated the ambience of long-lost imperialistic elegance in its fabric and culture should seek shelter by huddling under a hyper-modern structure like the dome. It was a failing of the set she moved through, she thought, that they never strived for anything new. The talent and resources deployed here could just as easily have been used to create something bold and innovative. Instead, they turned automatically to the past, drowning themselves in the safety of their genteel heritage. Yet, for her, the replication was less than perfect. She recognized the quality of crispness in the lines of the buildings, a cold efficiency in a determinedly handsome layout which betrayed the mentality of its originators. Monaco was a compact bundle of wealth, its borders jealously guarded. It had become an enclave, a fortified castle of the rich, complete with drawbridge. Even with her whiter-than-white passport and prepaid hotel reservation, the immigration officials had taken their time before allowing her in. Permanent residency within the principality was strictly limited. You had to be proposed by 3 residents and demonstrate assets in excess of 4 million euro francs before you could even register for consideration. So, Charlotte stood in the airport arrivals lounge in a queue of impatient, nervous people, watching enviously as resident cardholders zipped through their channel without any fuss. She had been afraid the hard-nosed woman behind the customs desk would open the flower box in her flight bag, ask questions about it. But the customs and immigration setup seemed more like a ritual than anything else. The wait, the questions, underlining that Monaco was different, not some common tourist resort or gambling state. It was while she was standing there that she saw the man for the second time that day. He was in the same queue, 10 places behind her. There was something about him, the way his cool eyes were never looking at her when she turned round, his phlegmatic indifference to queuing, which set him slightly apart. Creepy, almost. At any other time she would have guessed him to be a hard-line bodyguard for some Monaco plutocrat, coming home after a holiday. But she had seen him earlier in the day at the Cape Town spaceport, mingling among the crowd of friends and relatives that had greeted the other passengers on her spaceplane flight. If she had seen him in the departure lounge, waiting for the connecting flight to Monaco, then it would only be natural for him to be standing in the queue behind her. But what had he been doing in the crowd waiting for the spaceplane? Finally, her passport had been cleared, her invitation and hotel reservation validated by the immigration officer, a matronly woman in a stiff blue uniform. Charlotte obediently thumbprinted the declaration on the officer's terminal, confirming that she had read and would abide by the principality's laws. She received her temporary visa from the unsmiling woman. Their eyes had met for a second, and Charlotte read the uniquely female contempt for the thousandth time. She had worn a scarlet ashmi jumpsuit for her flight back to Earth, tucked into black leather cowboy boots, gold Amstrad Cyberfax wafer clipped into her top pocket, Ferranti sunglasses. About as expensively casual as you could get. She enjoyed the look in the mirror, a designer test pilot. Then the immigration bitch went and smashed her mood. It was an appropriate entrance to Monaco, she thought later, scorn and suspicion dogging her steps. The El Hahari Hotel was much different to the others ringing the inside of the dome, a little larger perhaps. Its colonnaded frontage a pearl-white marble that glowed pink in the directionless sunset. The Aston Martin swept smoothly up a looped drive lined by tall, bushy-topped palm trees. There was a stream of cars ahead of it, disgorging passengers outside the hotel's main entrance. The El Hahari was hosting the annual Newfields Ball, a charity that sponsored educational courses for underprivileged children throughout Europe. There was nothing remarkable about the charity, or the ball. At least half a dozen similar fundraising events were held in Monaco every night. But Newfields rose far above the ordinary by having Julia Evans on its board of trustees, making its ball the social event of the month. Tickets were 7,000 euro francs apiece. Touts charged 20 and cursed their scarcity. Dmitry Baranski, Charlotte's sponsor, had managed to get her one, shaking his head in dismay when she phoned him with the request. "What on earth do you want to go to that function for?" he'd asked. His thin, lined face seemed more fragile than usual, white hair drooping limply. The valley outside the Presda Arcology, where he lived, was visible through his apartment's picture window behind him. "I just want to see Julia Evans," Charlotte had replied equitably. "I've always admired her. Meeting her would be a real treat." She didn't like holding out on the old man, but it was a harmless piece of fun, exciting too, in its own way. That was the real reason she had agreed to make the delivery. She had spent years striving to bring stability into her life, overlooking the fact that it was the partner of monotony. "All right," Baronski had grumbled, "but all she'll do is shake your hand and thank you for supporting the charity. Same as everybody else. You won't be invited back to Willem Manor for tea on the lawn, you know."
"I don't expect to be. A handshake will suit me fine."
It had taken him 6 hours to track down a ticket for her. She never doubted he could do it. Then, when he called her at the Cape Town spaceport to confirm,
He also told her to introduce herself to Jason Whiteheart as soon as she reached the El Hahari.
"He's a nice enough old boy, and he's English, too. So you should get on fine."
"Okay." She had kept her face perfectly composed, just as Baronski himself had trained her, not letting her disappointment show. But it would have been nice to go to just one ball as a regular guest.
Baronski squirted Jason Whitehurst's data profile into her cyberfax for her to study during the flight to Monaco, and signed off, chuntering. She smiled fondly at the cyberfax screen after his image had faded. Nothing ever seemed to faze the old duffer. No request too obtuse for him to handle. His shadowy web of contacts rivaled a superpower's intelligence agency. It was a job Charlotte would love to take over when he retired. She suspected most of his girls shared that ambition. The footman who opened the Aston Martin's door was dressed in smart grey livery. Charlotte alighted gracefully, careful not to smile when she caught his eyes straying to her legs as her skirt rode up on the car's cushioning. She'd had 10-centimetre bone grafts put in her legs, 6 centimetres above the knee, 4 below. Her muscles had been recontoured around the extensions. It was an expensive treatment, but well worth it. Her new legs were powerfully athletic, beautifully shaped, designed to make men wish. 5 huge aureate chandeliers hung in the El Hahari's lobby, throwing a silver haze of light over the guests as they filed into the ballroom. The men wore formal dinner jackets, although some of them had military-style regalia complete with swords. The women were all in long gowns, dripping with diamonds. Charlotte moved easily through the crowd, holding the flower presentation box in her left hand. Her gown was made from navy blue silk with a décolleté neckline. With her long neck and short, clipped, sandy hair, it looked as though she was showing more skin than she actually was. She felt, rather than saw, several of the men watching her. She accepted a glass of champagne from the waiter, taking a sip as she looked round. The plush ballroom was nearly full. Long stalactites of freshly cut flowers floated above the milling partygoers. A large orchestra occupied the raised stage. She saw a pair of matched Mercedes coupés on the side of the highly polished wooden dance floor, the raffle's grand prize. Julia Evans was standing at the centre of a small group of Newfields committee members, greeting a long queue of guests. A dinner-jacketed Channel Gossip Cast cameraman covered each introduction. Charlotte studied her closely. The owner of Event Horizon was 34, tall, with an attractive oval face and light complexion. Her chestnut hair was worn long and straight, falling halfway down her back. Her dress was emerald green, a fabric as smooth as oil. Stylish rather than ostentatious. Even her jewellery was modest, a few small intricate pieces, making the elderly gem-bedecked dowagers in the queue seem absurdly gauche in comparison. It was almost as though Julia Evans was using her own refinement to mock the crass flamboyance around her. Charlotte found it difficult to look away. Julia Evans's reputation exerted an intrinsic fascination. She had inherited Event Horizon, aged 17, from her equally famous grandfather, Philip Evans, and had gone on to run it with the kind of barbed efficiency which was beyond any of its rivals. The company's fortune was based on its gigaconductor patent, a universal energy storage system used to power everything from household gear to space planes. Julia had shrewdly exploited the money which licensing brought in to expand Event Horizon until it dominated the post-warming English economy. There were just so many legends and rumours, so much gossip connected with this one woman, it was hard to relate all the allegations and acclaim to the slim figure standing a few metres away. Watching her, Charlotte decided there was something different about her after all. A kind of glacial discipline. Julia's small, polite smile never faltered as she was introduced to the torrent of eager dignitaries. It was almost a regal quality.
"Genuine power has an attraction more fundamental than gravity," Baronski once told Charlotte. "No matter whether it is an influence for good or supreme evil, it pulls people in and holds them spellbound."
The effect Julia Evans had on people made Charlotte realize just how true that was. The snippets of conversation she'd overheard so far in the ballroom were all mundane small talk. Everyone knew that Julia Evans didn't like to talk shop at social functions. It was faintly ridiculous. The whole Mediterranean coast was talking about the new alliance between Egypt and the Turkish Islamic Republic, worried about how it would affect regional trade, whether a new jihad legion would rise in North Africa. And the people here must be the most interested of all. They stood to make or lose fortunes on the outcome. But there wasn't a word. She remembered a midnight conversation with one of her patrons, a high-grade financier, 2 or 3 years previously. He had confessed that his children were deliberately conceived to be the same age as Julia's 2 children, in the hope they would prove acceptable playmates. That all-elusive key to the innermost coterie. At the time, Charlotte had shaken her head in bemused disbelief. Now she wasn't so sure. Julia Evans's tawny eyes found Charlotte across the ballroom. With a guilty start, Charlotte realized she must have been staring for well over a minute. She hurriedly took a sip of champagne to cover herself, gawking like some adolescent wannabe who'd unexpectedly bumped into her idol. Thank heavens Baronski wasn't here to witness such a lapse. Charlotte quickly scanned the faces in the background. Before the party, she had reviewed Julia Evans's data profile, the one Associated Press assembled, looking for someone close to her. She had sifted carefully through the information, deciding on 3 names which might provide a shortcut to access. She walked round the end of the queue, towards the knot of people behind Julia Evans. Rachel Griffith was chatting to one of the Newfields committee members, a middle-aged woman trying not to let her boredom show. The data profile had said she'd been with Julia Evans for 19 years, starting out as a bodyguard, then moving over to personal assistant when she got too old for hardliner activity. She gave Charlotte a quizzical look. There was that instant snap of recognition, condescension registering.
Yes. Would you see Julia Evans gets this, please?
Charlotte handed over the box. It was 25 centimetres long, 10 wide, with a transparent top showing the single mauve trumpet-shaped flower inside. A white bow was tied round the middle. Rachel Griffith took it in reflex, then gave the box a disparaging frown.
Who's it from? There is a card.
It was in a small blank envelope tucked under the ribbon. Charlotte didn't quite have the courage to open it and read the message herself. As she turned away, she said,
"Thank you so much,"
all sugary pleasant, to show how indifferent she was, rewarded by Rachel Griffith's vexed expression. The box wouldn't be forgotten now. Charlotte felt pleased with herself, making the connection with so much aplomb. How many other people could hand-deliver articles to the richest woman in the world and be sure they'd reach their destination? Baronski had taught her a damn sight more than etiquette and culture. There was an art to handling yourself in this kind of company. Perhaps that was why he had selected her. His scout in the orphanage staff must have recognized some kind of inherent ability. Character was more important than beauty in this game. Charlotte let herself be talked into a couple of dances before she started looking for her new patron. She'd be damned if she didn't get some enjoyment out of the party. The young men were charming, as they always were when they thought they were conversing with an equal, both in their 20s. One of them was at university in Oslo. They were good dancers. She thought she saw the creep from the airport while she was on the dance floor, dressed in a waiter's white jacket. But he was on the other side of the ballroom, and he had his back to her, so it was hard to tell, and she certainly wasn't going to stop dancing to check. She located Jason Whitehurst in one of the side rooms. It was a refuge for the older people, with plenty of big leather armchairs and waiter service. The data profile from Baronski said Jason Whitehurst was 66, a wealthy independent trader with a network of cargo agents all across the globe. She thought he looked like a Russian czar, straight-backed, a pointed white beard, wearing the dress uniform of the King's Own Hussars. There was a discreet row of ribbons pinned on his chest. She recognized the one which was for the Mexico campaign. His eyes must have been implants, they were so clear, and startlingly blue. According to the profile, Jason Whitehurst had a son, but there was no wife. Charlotte was relieved about that. Wives were a complication she could do without. Some simply ignored her, others treated her like a daughter. The worst were the ones who wanted to watch. Jason Whitehurst was in conversation with a couple of contemporaries, the 3 of them standing together with large brandy glasses in their hands. She walked right up and introduced herself.
"Ah, yes, the old Baron told me you'll be here," Jason Whitehurst said.
His voice was beautifully clipped and precise. He left his friends with a brief wave. She liked that. There was no pretense, no charade that she was a relative or a friend's daughter. It spoke of complete self-confidence. Jason Whitehurst didn't have to care what anyone else thought. He could make a good patron, she thought. People like him always did. A man who had made a success of his life wasn't inclined to quibble over trivia. Not that money ever came into it. And there was an established routine, no need for vulgarity. And Baronski would never tolerate anyone who didn't play by the rules. While she was with him, the patron would pay for all her clothes, her travel, incidentals, and there would be gifts, mostly jewellery, perfume, sometimes art, once a racehorse. She still laughed at Baronsky's consternation over that. After it was over, after the patron had tired of her, Baronsky would gather in all her gifts and pay her a straight 20%.
"Are your bags packed?" Jason Whitehurst asked.
"Yes, sir."
"Jason, please, my dear. Like to keep an informal house?"
She inclined her head.
"Good," he said. "We'll be leaving Monaco right after this blessed fandango."
"Baronsky said you were voyaging to Odessa," she said.
"Always show an interest in their activities. Make them think everything they do is important." Jason Whitehurst stared at her.
"Yes. Have you been to Odessa before?"
"No, I'm afraid not."
"Beastly place. I do a little trade there, no other reason to go. Lord knows what'll happen now Turkey's plugged in with Egypt, though. Still, not your concern. Phone your hotel. Tell them my chauffeur will pick up your luggage. He'll take it down to the airport for you."
"Pardon me?"
"Now what?"
"I thought we were voyaging on your yacht."
Jason Whitehurst pulled at his beard. She couldn't tell if he was amused or angry.
"Ought to read your data profiles a little closer, dear girl. Now then, I've got some people to see here first, so in the meantime I want you to find Fabian. Get acquainted."
"Your son?"
"That's right. Do you know what he looks like?"
She remembered the picture in the data profile, a 15-year-old boy with thick dark hair coming down over his ears.
"I think I can recognize him, yes."
"Excellent. Just go where the noise is loudest, that's where he'll be. Now then, a few words of caution. Little chap doesn't have many real friends. My fault, I expect. Keep him on board the Colonel Maitland all the time. Not terribly used to company, so make allowances, yes?"
"Certainly."
"Good. I've told him you'll be meeting us here. A splendid girl like you is exactly what he needs. As you can imagine, he's looking forward to your company enormously, so don't disappoint him."
"You want me?"
Charlotte trailed off in surprise.
"You and Fabian, yes. Problem?"
The idea threw her completely. But in the end, she supposed, it didn't make any real difference.
"No."
She found she couldn't look Jason Whitehurst in the face any more.
"Jolly good. I'll see the two of you in about an hour in my car. Don't be late."
Jason Whitehurst marched off, leaving Charlotte alone with the realization that no matter how well you thought you knew them, the ultra-rich were not even remotely human. Fabian Whitehurst was easy enough to find. There were only about 15 boys and girls in their early teens at the ball, and they were all clustered together outside the entrance to the disco. They were giggling loudly, red-faced as they swapped jokes. Charlotte made a slow approach across the ballroom, taking her time to study them. She was only too well accustomed to the inherent brattishness of the children of the rich. Spoilt and ignored, they developed a shell of arrogance early in life, treating everyone else as third-class citizens, including Charlotte. In some cases, especially Charlotte. Her throat muscles tensed at the memories. These seemed no different. Their voices grated from 10 meters away, high-pitched and raffish. The girls had been given salon treatments, fully made up, their hair in elaborate arrangements. They nearly all wore white dresses, though a couple were in low-cut gowns. There was something both silly and sad about the amount of jewellery they wore. The boys were in dinner jackets and dress shirts. Charlotte was struck by their similarity, as if they were all cousins. Their cheeks chubby, moving awkwardly, making an effort to be boisterous. She imagined someone had told them this was the way you had to behave at parties, and they were all scrabbling to conform. Then she caught sight of Fabian Whitehurst, the tallest of the group. His face didn't have quite the pampered look of the others. She could see some of his father's characteristics in his angled jawline and high cheekbones. Handsome little devil, she thought. He'll be a real handful when he grows up. Fabian suddenly looked up. For the second time in one evening, Charlotte felt flustered. There was something demanding in his gaze. But he couldn't keep it going, blushing crimson and dropping his eyes quickly. She waited. Fabian glanced up, guiltily. She lifted the corner of her mouth, gently, a conspiracy smile, then let her attention wander away. Julia Evans was dancing on the ballroom's wooden floor, with some ancient nobleman sporting a purple stripe across his tailcoat. Maybe there were penalties for being so rich, after all. Charlotte knew that if she had that much money, she would have taken her pick of the handsomest young blades, the ones who could make her laugh and feel all light inside, and screw protocol. She took another sip of champagne.
Hello. You look awfully bored, Fabian said.
He was standing in front of her, an oversized velvet bow tie spoiling the sartorial chic of his tailored dinner jacket. His shaggy hair was almost falling in his eyes as he looked up at her. He flipped it aside with a toss of his head.
"Oh, dear, does it show?" she asked encouragingly.
Out of the corner of her eye she could see all the other youngsters watching them with eager, envious expressions.
"No. Well, sort of, a bit. I'm Fabian Whitehurst."
His eyes darted down to her cleavage, then away again, as if it was a dare.
"Yes, I know. Your father said I'd find you over here. I'm Charlotte Fielder. Pleased to meet you."
"Crikey!"
Fabian's gasp of surprise was almost a shout. He blushed hotly again at the solecism, his shoulders hunching up in reflex. His voice dropped to a whisper.
"You? You're Charlotte?"
And for a moment every aristocratic pretension was stripped away. He was an ordinary, incredulous 15-year-old who didn't have a clue.
"Afraid so."
Training halted the giggle as it formed in her throat. But he was funny to watch.
"Oh!"
A spark of jubilation burned in Fabian's eyes.
"I wondered if you would care to dance," he said breathlessly.
"Thank you. I'd like that,"
she said, and drained the glass. Fabian's grin was arrogant triumph. They walked into the disco together, past Fabian's astonished friends. He gave them a fast thumbs up, lips curling into a smug sneer. Charlotte's serene smile never flickered.